everyone. This is Lynn Harder, co-producer and host of Defining Moments podcast. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Ann Kerber and Dr. Christy Oding of Minnesota State University, Mankato. Ann is an associate professor in the Department of Communication and Media, and Christy is an audiologist and an associate professor of speech, hearing, and rehabilitation services. Together, they help coordinate a community garden, a built environment that by design is responsive to people of diverse abilities. As an art form, gardening engages multiple senses: sight, smell, taste, touch, and even sound. Anchoring today's episode is an article published in Health Communication titled "Garden Engagement: Cultivating Cultures of Care Through Artful Placemaking." Artful placemaking is an alternative approach to organizing and teaching care for people with Alzheimer's and other related dementias. The essay reveals the therapeutic potential of gardening, and at the same time, the work unsettles dominant narratives of aging that too often focus on deficits and loss of abilities. Ann and Christy, thank you for your life-enriching work, and thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I've really been looking forward to this conversation. When the article came across my desk, it moved me to the extent that I integrated it in a class that I was teaching this past spring. So I feel like I've been learning along with you and all of the voices that you bring into this essay for a while now. And now we get to open up that conversation to a broader audience. So to start, Christy, might you take us back in time and narrate the origins of the Garden Engagement Project?
Yeah, this program started back in 2019, and it was thought of by three faculty members here at Minnesota State University, Mankato. And it was also not just them, but also it was kind of a collaboration with the Mankato and North Mankato Act on Alzheimer's Action Group, which is a community group that is trying to kind of understand what does the community of Mankato understand about dementia, what's their knowledge about it. And then once they figure that out, they create these programs to make our community more dementia friendly, which is, you know, making sure that people who are living with dementia in Mankato feel supported, understood, and included, and also their families too, and their caregivers feel supported, and just trying to reduce that stigma and create awareness of dementia. So the faculty members here, Drs. Kristen Abbott Anderson, who was in nursing, Dr. Sheen Cho, who is in speech, hearing, and rehabilitation services, and Dr. Brooke Burke, who was in recreation and parks leadership studies. Those three first kind of created this idea. And then Dr. Kristen Abbott Anderson and Dr. Sheen Cho are the ones that really brought this garden forward over those remaining years. So they saw, after working with ACT on Alzheimer's, they were talking about what is something that we could create in the community that would be engaging, because there weren't a lot of opportunities at the time. And, you know, some of the benefits of engagement when someone has dementia, you know, it can reduce isolation, it can improve someone's quality of life, not only for that person, but the family members as well, and also help with adjustments. So they were thinking, and they kind of came up with this idea of, let's create a garden, because, you know, we have this time in the summer, and our students are always looking for some things to do. And it can be a very creative and engaging way to make relationships with people. So they created this idea. And what was really cool to me, I think, is not only were these three programs involved, but throughout the years as this has gone on, you know, communication and media, aviation, accounting, dietetics, health sciences, dental, social work, and so many other programs have become involved. So through that collaboration, they created this garden, and they not only saw it as a way to, you know, get community members involved who have dementia, but also our students, and teach them and all their faculty what are the best practices in working with someone who has dementia. These skills are important when, You know, we go out into the work setting, not just in healthcare, but also in our personal lives and with people that we see in the community. So they do this formal training where they, through Dementia Friends, where they teach people the skills they need to work with someone who has dementia and make it a meaningful experience for them. And yeah, and that's how this was all created.
Oh, okay, this is why I wanted to invite you all to be a part of our podcast. What you're doing is innovative, it is imaginative, and it is world building for people who too often experience isolation due to some of the difficulties that surround dementia and Alzheimer's. And you're responding to those life circumstances in ways that enlarge their sense of what's possible. And it's just incredible work. I applaud your whole team for what you're doing. So kudos. Part of what is so provocative and potent about this project is its capacity to foster intergenerational storytelling. And I'm hoping that maybe you can talk to us generally about the narrative nature of this work.
You bet. So what I think and what I find really powerful about this program is that it facilitates opportunities for positive and meaningful connections between students, many of whom are training to go into different health professions and some who are training to go into other professions, but many of whom will be working with people who are aging and really helping them start to understand, I think, the possibilities and potentials that are available as they connect with aging adults. One of the things that I love about this program is the dementia-friendly training offers a really wonderful kind of scaffolding for students to think about how to interact. Let's say they don't have a connection with a grandparent or another aging adult, I think it offers them with some ideas on how to create those meaningful interactions. So that training provides students with a little bit of information about what's it like to live with dementia. What are some of the best practices for creating dementia-friendly conversations? So for instance, making sure that you're offering guiding and reassuring statements, that you're avoiding quizzing type questions or making corrective comments about what they do and don't get wrong in remembering previous interactions. And also avoiding some of the pitfalls of how people sometimes talk to aging adults, where it's a little overly patronizing or might be a little bit like baby talk. So kind of avoiding those potential pitfalls, but then also thinking about what is possible in terms of creating a conversation there. And then also providing them, when they're in the garden, with these multi-sensory experiences that open up opportunities to have conversations. So for instance, when the residents arrive, one of the first things that we do is we walk through the garden and just take time to notice what's going on in the garden, what's changing in the garden. We're kind of in this exciting period right now where things have been planted, but they're just starting to come up. And we don't know what the garden's going to be like in a couple of weeks, but it's continually changing. So it's fun to notice what's different every time that we're there. We also have things like memory books that are filled with reminiscent images and stories, that they're 1 to 2, maybe full color pictures per page with a label and a description that they can read together with a student, the participants and the students can read together. But they also provide visualization and some context for participants, and usually those spark conversations and stories. And what the memory that might get stimulated by that image can vary, but it offers up an entry point into having a conversation. And then there's lots of other activities that we do that, again, allow for that conversation and interaction to kind of open up, whether it's, you know, making balloon animals or painting or tasting things that come out of the garden or having an ice cream social. These moments of opportunity and connection spark the ability for people to tell stories to one another, but they also help students learn to focus on responding to participants and what's interesting to them in the moment and where they're at in that moment. And there's a lot of times when something might not engage one of the participants, students get practicing with, okay, well, you know, let's try something else. Let's look at a memory book. Let's, you know, just enjoy being together in the sunshine in this space. And so it gives them, again, those tools for having a meaningful conversation, but then also helping them start to appreciate the need for some flexibility and improvisation so that they can meet people where they're at and, again, just enjoy being present together with one another.
It's so much of our healthcare system is guided by this narrative of technology as progress. And anchoring that narrative is a metaphor of hope as a cure. And I think what I find so captivating about your work is that you're illustrating that hope doesn't always have to be a cure. Hope can sometimes be a warm summer afternoon where you're out picking beans or you're smelling rosemary, right? Or tactily, you're pulling weeds. Hope has an expanded sense in the work that you're doing. And in many ways, and I think in the essay that accompanies this podcast, at one point you actually talk about this project as a remedy to some of the limits of how we think about age, how we think about caring for people who are aging and who might be experiencing related dementias. So just really incredibly important work that you're doing. I'm wondering, for our listeners who haven't read your essay, if one of you would be willing to read the reflection that starts your essay itself.
Yes, so this narrative is, the beginning of the gardening is an exciting time. After a long, harsh winter, the grass finally starts growing and the soil is rich with nutrients. The air is gentle and fresh, and the sunshine is promising with warmth. Student volunteers plant a wide variety of seeds ranging from flowers to herbs and vegetables. Some students bring their experience working on their family farm, while others with no experience awkwardly scoop the mulch and dig the soil. The smell of the dirt and the mulch touches their noses, while the soft and cool texture of the soil wakes up their hands and fingers in ways that a touchscreen cannot. The garden invites their hands to reach out and participate. The soil is tempting for touch and forgiving of any potential mishandling. Interacting with the soil brings back childhood memories and a sense of agency. The setting is not only multisensory, but it is inherently participatory. Everyone helps in ways they can. And we let go, other than watering and weeding several times a week, we entrust nature to do its magic of turning the tiny seeds into abundant crops.
Poetic and beautiful reflection that, for me, reveals how you're creating and holding space for relational development and building connections between learning and local contexts. And what's revealed in that excerpt is how gardens are repositories of memories. And I suspect, and I would love to hear more about this, that if dementia really impacts your short-term memory, some of those smells and the tastes and the textures might be able to resonate with the longer term memory, right? When you're observing a ripening tomato or smelling sage, right? It might spark conversations about memories of gardening and cooking and family gatherings.
It definitely does. I think that there, just having been in the garden last week, we were discussing, one of the participants and I, the different kinds of flowers that her mother always planted. And it was just a really remarkable moment where I think the opportunity to connect over a picture of a flower that was in a memory book, because that's what we were looking at, one of the memory books together. And she said, oh, that's one that was something that we planted in our own garden. Was just really, it was one of those beautiful moments of connection. And then that kind of sparked me talking about my grandparents' garden, which is something that was a fun long-term memory for me in terms of things that I recalled doing and had an opportunity to connect with them over. And so for me, it was not just about making that connection with her, but kind of linking back to the nostalgic moments that bring me joy, but then also the joy of you seeing the joy in her of being able to have this conversation and to talk about something that was, again, remembering something that was lovely, but then also being in that moment together. So kind of bringing the past together with where we were in the moment and just having that opportunity to talk and, again, be together outside was really beautiful.
Christy, can you walk us through kind of the step-by-step process of how the garden engagement project unfolds in a typical season? It sounds like you're just in the beginning, right, of growth.
That's right. Yeah, we get started when spring comes around. We start planning and thinking about what types of plants we might want to have in the garden and activities for the spring. And I'll say over the last couple of years, what I've really loved to see is the students taking ownership of that. So we've had some really lovely graduate and undergraduate students who have stepped in. And what really I loved about them taking over was they actually went to a facility that comes and brings their residents every week and asked them and their caretakers, what do they like? What flowers do you like? Which vegetables do you like? What kind of activities do you like to do? And they incorporated that into the programming. So it's not just us arbitrarily thinking of like, what would we like and looking at the literature and thinking about it, but also like incorporating their interests into it too, which I think is really lovely. So once we have that, then we do a Dementia Friends training the month of April before we start gardening. And this gives everybody who's involved in the program those tools and skills needed to learn how do I interact, you know, with someone that has dementia appropriately. Like we learn, pause 20 seconds after you say something to give that person some time to formulate a response if they would like. So we, as Anne was saying, we learn all these different skills. And then we start to plant our garden in mid to late May. One thing I want to say that's really cool this year too was when we went to our garden center to pick up the plants for planting that day, they got really into it themselves. So they were like, let me help you find plants that are really fun to feel, to look at, to smell, taste. And that was really cool to see even the garden center getting into it. And they even donated the plants, which was really sweet. So we have not only community involvement in that way too. And then once we get the garden planted, we do that in a day. And we put up our mailbox where we can have a little notebook that people can write memories in. Then that following week, we start our hourly programming where we have people from a facility here in Mankato. They put them on a bus and bring them up to us at the garden and we start our programming. But not only just them, but people from the community are welcome to join too. So anyone who would like to come is welcome to. And we do this from kind of the end of May till the end of July.
I remember from my time living in Moorhead, Minnesota, that May to July were some of my favorite months in the state.
The summer season is short, sadly. And so I think there is something really beautiful and in connection with the seasons, like we're, you know how it is, Lynn, it gets to be like 50, 60 degrees and everyone's outside and people are ready to start digging in the dirt. And it's that sense of excitement and what the garden can be and what kinds of relationships might form is really present in this initial starting off phase when we're getting going. And then watching what continually emerges week by week as, you know, new flowers and new plants are blooming and we start to see the first buds of tomatoes and beans and zucchini and things like that. It's hard to see those relationships develop between the students and the residents too. And those kinds of connections are beautiful to watch them sort of unfold in the time that we have together.
I can imagine sitting by a warm fire in December when there's snow on the ground and the temperature might be below zero, having something to look forward to in terms of being outside when the climate is a little bit warmer. I can imagine how powerful it is, even in that season of hibernation, right? As you're readying for a season of growth. Listening to both of you, I am very much reminded that the imagination is always already at the heart of gardening, right? How gardens are constructed, the meanings that are brought to particular spaces, who belongs in them and what capacity. I love that your students and the residents, community members they work with, have opportunities to, based on their memories, make choices about what flowers and plants to include because they know they'll be able to touch the softness of a lamb's ear, right? Or to really enjoy the pungency of basil when it's in bloom, the sensory stimuli that come from this living laboratory that's composed of sunlight and weather and winds and colors, smells, sounds, temperatures, all of that allows for a cultivating of a sensory way of knowing the world. And as an educator, I have to believe that that is connected to the sort of catalytic learning we want for our students, where it really transforms you. It shifts the way that you think and how you interact with others. Building on that, let's talk about this built environment that you've created for the garden that by design is inclusive for people of all abilities and needs. Can you talk to us a little bit about your intentionality in how you're designing this place?
You know, my colleague, again, Dr. Sheen Cho, she really has thought heavily about this because during, I will say, our regular semester year, she has our undergraduate students going to this facility and they make these memory books. So they're asking people their history, things they like, they have pictures and they put them in this book. So that way when family members come or someone wants to interact with this person, they can pull out their book and it will have things that will spark conversation with that person because it's things that they love. And one thing that she did was create memory books, like Anne had said, where that's pictures of many different things from weather to flowers to food to, you know, different periods of time, clothing, and they can look through these books and spark conversation. And there's lots of research back behind that is one great way to facilitate, you know, communication with someone that has dementia. Like Ed said too, purposely picking up plants that have meaning to the people that are coming as well as activities can be really huge for people. I'll give like an example. You know, we have a little ice cream social, and that's probably one of my favorite things to see when we do this because it just brings back everyone is, I feel like, becomes a child when they eat ice cream because it brings those memories back. And I'll just, every time we have that, like people's eyes just light up and they're so excited to get an ice cream bar. So it's kind of cool to see that. Just also too, like the space itself is accessible. So there is transportation, like I said, from that facility that brings them to the garden, but the pathways are wide so that we can have someone in a wheelchair. So we purposely do that. You know, there are benches for people to sit too if they prefer that in the shade or if they want to be in the sun.
There are raised beds so that people don't have to bend down. I mean, we've got some that are lower to the ground, but there are raised beds for people who might have difficulty with accessing the flowers that are there as well, which is nice. We've tried to build in a lot of those sorts of things. Thank you.
Hi, folks. This is Lynn breaking in for just a second. We've been talking to Ann Kerber and Christy Oding, members of a team coordinating a community garden, a built environment that by design is responsive to people of diverse abilities. For your convenience, we've placed links to their recently published article in Health Communication on our Facebook page. Okay, back to the conversation. Recently, I completed reading a book that I think both of you would find compelling. The title of it, and I'm not going to probably get it completely right, but it's close. It's by Sarah Hendren. And I think the first part of the title is, What Can a Body Do? And her book goes on to answer that question. What a body can do depends on the social and built and natural environments in which bodies interact. And a key takeaway in answering a question that way is we ought to be mindful of building environments in which there are harmonious fits between bodies and the world that they move in. And so, Anne, the example that you gave about the raised garden bed making it easier for perhaps someone who's in a wheelchair, that's a beautiful example of an inclusion in the world of gardening. Bodies and people who might otherwise not be able to reach down to the ground, right?
Yeah.
So what you're doing from my perspective is you're also reminding us that while we tend to think about health experiences as individuals, and certainly we all experience the pinched nerve in our back, the osteoarthritis in our hip, right? The insulin that an individual takes for diabetes. And if that's the only way that we think about health, we have a really limited perspective. So in answering that question, what can a body do? It shifts our attention to what happens between people and between people and environments. And so individuals who are aging and might have Alzheimer's or related dementia, there's still capacity there. We need to figure out how to create environments in which hope is possible. And hope can take on a lot of different meanings in that context. So book by Sarah Hendren, both for you and for our listeners out there, I think just a really compelling way of thinking about how we always already experience well-being in places and in relationships with others.
To that too, I think to, you know, as a society, I think we also need to consider we do have a large population that is moving into that aging cohort. And how do we think about the way our world is designed is inclusive or not inclusive of those different needs and abilities? You know, it can be dementia and Alzheimer's disease, or it can be things like chronic illness that we're talking about. But how do we design spaces, not just in programs like these, but in our broader world, that allow people or allow for more inclusion of people of all abilities? And how do we think about the ways in which we design spaces? This became really clear to me this spring. Unfortunately, a family member broke a leg, and just watching them try to navigate a world in which their physical constraints made it very difficult for them to be in a world that, you know, in some ways we have made a lot of progress in terms of trying to be more inclusive of bodies of different abilities. And there are still some places where it's really frustrating that we're not more inclusive. But I think, you know, thinking about this in the context of Alzheimer's and dementia is important, and I'm glad we do it. But I think it has expanded my thinking about how do we do this for other bodies that are often marked or designated as deviating from what we consider to be normal or well, and how do we design spaces that allow for their inclusion and their participation?
And I want to riff with you and Christy on this a bit, because I think that your work and your essay provides a really meaningful answer to that question that is movable beyond the context of Alzheimer's and related dementias. So you developed this concept of artful placemaking, right? And certainly this is multidimensional. It includes alternative ways of training future health professionals. It's also about creating spaces that are responsive to the unique needs, interests, and abilities of people, and being able to know in place, to be in place, and to make together. So let's talk, Anne, a little bit about this notion of artful placemaking and how it's really trying to transform cultures of care.
Absolutely. So I think one of the things that's important about garden engagement is that it takes place in a setting that is outside of a classroom or a care facility, which I think is really important when you're thinking about how we train health professionals. A lot of those traditional spaces, such as a classroom or that care facility, have relationships that are sort of expected in terms of how we will encounter each other. So there's kind of an expected relationship between a patient and a health provider in terms of how they're going to interact with one another. As we train future health providers, there are checklists or very specific scaffolding that we offer students to interact with the people who are in those spaces. And what I love about garden engagement is it takes those away, right? You're engaging in a space where you don't have that kind of pre-scripted sort of relationship to each other. Mm-hmm. And you're doing that in a space where, again, we talk about this in terms of the connection of knowing, making, and being in the garden. You know, you're doing this in a space that rather than having those other ways of knowing that are privileged, you're really privileging the memories and the cultural practices that are typically associated with gardens, because those are the things that make it a place where people want to be. You know, I think there's something really beautiful about gardens where they're just aesthetically and in terms of, you know, being in the sunshine, being near things that smell good, we want to be there. But there are also spaces where we can tap into that storytelling and the imaginary of what things can be, what they can look like, whether it's, you know, transforming them into rows of plants or thinking about the relationships that might get fostered there. And there are also spaces where everyone can participate too. So in terms of that making piece, you know, they're inclusive spaces for people of all abilities. And then also because you've taken away those power relationships that are traditionally associated with kind of health environments, they're spaces where we can make together in ways that are different. You know, we can be playing with kinetic sand while we're having a conversation. We can be looking at a memory book together and find those ways of connecting with one another. And then also kind of being in that garden space creates new ways of noticing the world around us. So it's not just about, you know, the noticing what's happening with people, but it's also about appreciating the sensory stimuli that's in the garden around us, the sunshine. You know, a lot of times the conversations might just unfold around what a beautiful day it is, how the garden is growing, what's happening, what's changing, but also appreciating what we perceive and sense about others. So how do we learn to watch for cues about when somebody's really feeling one of the things that we're doing, or when maybe that's not for them that particular day, but we might be able to pivot and do something else? A great example of this is I think this was two summers ago in the garden. One of the activities that we were doing was like a little bit of a trivia kind of game. And there was one particular individual at the table with me who wasn't interacting. There were several other people who were interacting and were kind of engaging with the questions. And he wasn't really interacting. And because I was new to the space, I was like, oh, he's not into this. But I think the more time I have spent there and the more I come to understand about being dementia friendly, it might just be that for him, just being there listening to the conversation kind of unfolding around him was meaningful, and that I didn't necessarily need to jump in and try to pull him into the conversation. And so I think that it's learning about how do we use the space? How do we, learn those sensory cues to kind of figure out what people need in that moment, and how to be together, not just together in kind of relationship to each other, but together in that garden space as well.
What if we organized care around what is possible and not simply what isn't possible? What if we organized around possibility? That challenges dominant narratives that tend to view aging as decline. And we all understand that. I'm middle-aged. My body's shifting on a regular basis. Things that came easy to me 25 years ago feel different now, and that's okay. And there are things I'm experiencing in a richer way than I did when I was a teenager. So in many ways, the organizing around what is possible is challenging the limits of deficit-based problem-solving orientations to people who are living in diverse bodies. And so, amen to work that is trying to unsettle narratives in a way that enlarge our sense of what's possible. And that's exactly what you all are doing. As we wrap up our conversation, I would love to provide each of you an opportunity, and maybe Christy, we'll start with you, just to reflect on a defining or memorable moment of yours connected to work in the garden.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can think of many things, but it reminds me a lot. Working here reminds me a lot of my grandma, because she had dementia, and at the time I did not know how to interact and get those conversations with her. And so looking back, I have lots of regret. Like, I wish I knew these tools back then so that I could have had these meaningful connections with her. But that being said, it's so lovely that we're able to share these tools with people and learn these tools myself so that I can have meaningful connections. And I will say the first year that I did this, when we got towards the end of the year, you could see, like Anne was saying, those connections that students were getting with the people that came every week. And you felt the sense of sadness when they left, because you knew you weren't going to see them again till next year. And it just showed like how powerful that interaction is and those relationships were, because you could tell everyone felt happy that we had did it, but also the sense of sadness that it was ending, and those relationships, while they can start again the next year, or potentially, maybe they go and they continue that relationship and visit the person, at the care facility. But I think it just shows like how powerful and strong those relationships were when we were done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anne, how about you? Do you have a memory you would like to share with us?
Oh, yeah. I think one of the things that's been incredibly useful for me personally about participating in the garden is that I have a better understanding and appreciation for the fact that dementia is not a linear process, or that kind of age-related decline is not a linear process, and that people who are experiencing it are still capable of deep joy and connection. And I think to see that, because the people in the garden come to us in all kind of different stages of where they're at in their journey with dementia, I think has been really helpful too. One of my first interactions in the garden was with a woman who was, I don't know where she was in her journey, but she really opened up about past experiences. And you'll get a kick out of this, Lynn. Her dad had been a college football coach. Mm. And she had lots of stories to share about him and growing up being in a college environment, and how she kind of connected that to her life in Mankato. And it was just a really joyful and fun conversation that it really helped me kind of appreciate that everyone is on a different part of the journey, but then to just to be appreciative of joy, no matter where we're at as part of that journey. This last week, it was a woman whose smile reminded me of my own grandmother's, that was really memorable and joyful. And we bonded over the fact that she had sparkly tennis shoes. They were bedazzled in a way that I just thought were so cool. And I told her that, and she was so excited to share that. She's like, "You don't think they're too much?" And I said, "Absolutely not. They're wonderful." But I think to just recognize that there are so many moments of joy and things to be appreciated, no matter where people are on their journey, I think has been really valuable for me.
And therein lies the movability of your work. We've been talking about this in a context of Alzheimer's and related dementias, and this can be transported to other life spheres of activity in ways that inspire us all to try to be well in the midst of inescapable illness and hardship and trauma, that we can find micro doses of hope and cultivate that joy. And that is part of the human condition, right? Alongside the deep sorrow, right? All at once. We can experience that all at once.
Yes.
Thanks, everyone, for joining Ann Kerber, Christy Odine, and I for this episode of the Defining Moments podcast. Defining Moments is produced by WOUB Public Media and the Barbara Geralds Institute for Storytelling and Social Impact. The Storytelling Institute imagines a world where storytelling creates just and joyful communities. Joe Bianco and I are co-producers, and Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. You can subscribe to Defining Moments at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the NPR Podcast Directory. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at DM Podcast WOUB. In the show notes and on our Facebook page, we'll provide links to the recently published article in Health Communication about the Garden Engagement Project. Thank you, and be well.